You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. Maximize your effectiveness in the changing global business environment with the postgraduate Oxford Diploma in Global Business. Taught in four short modules over a year, the program is designed to accelerate your career and increase your impact while minimizing the disruption to your work and family life. Learn alongside senior executives from around the world and develop a lifelong network. Visit the Zayed Business School website to find out more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast, episode 44. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today, I'm in conversation with Johannes Becker, who is a professor of economics and the director of the Institute of Public Economics at the University of Münster in Germany. We're talking about the crucial issue of how to tax corporations in the 21st century. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, Johannes Becker, thank you very much indeed for taking the time this morning to talk to me about issues with taxation and what we could feasibly do about this. And in order to get us started, I mean, the issue of corporate taxation is regularly in the news. And you, as an expert in this field, what would you see as the biggest current problems in this area of corporate taxation? So where are the biggest pressure points from your point of view?
First of all, let me state that the issue with corporate taxation is not so much an issue with tax evasion. It's an issue of tax avoidance. That means legal means of reducing the firm's tax payments, tax liabilities. The current system of international taxation is based on the principle of source taxation. And that would mean that profits are taxed where profits are generated. And that is in itself a difficult concept, because if we have a multinational firm where a product is produced in many locations, then we need some concept, some principle that tells us which part of the profit is allocated to the different affiliates. And so in the modern economy, which is very much reliant on intangible assets, this is very hard to do. And many multinational firms, especially the digital firms, manage to allocate a large part of the profit to entities in low tax jurisdictions. And that, well, that gives people the impression that they are tax dodgers. So, what they do is legal. This is just say they stick to the rules that are in place, although some people say they rather bend them. So that means that many large, very profitable firms pay an effective tax rate on their worldwide income, which is far below 10%, sometimes even below 5% or 3%.
And I mean, hasn't that always been to some extent the problem between service, the service economy and industry? I mean, if you are in an industrial company, it's fairly easy to say, you know, the gearbox of that car was produced in location A and then shipped to location B, where it was actually put into the frame, right? So, but in services, it's always been a bit more difficult to identify where the value creation actually took place. Hasn't that been historically the case?
This is true, but the typical industrial firm, manufacturing firms like car companies, companies like Nike, for instance, that produce something tangible, they are to an increasing degree reliant on brands, on intangibles that BMW, for instance, very much profits from their global brand, right? And so this is within their company very much reliant on first management services, then the brand, as I just said. And so this is, you cannot draw this dividing line between the service sector and the manufacturing. So what I just said is equally true for the big and large manufacturing, for at least in the consumer sector.
Mm-hmm. So, but we generally have to shift, I mean, not just towards a more digital economy, but towards a more intangible economy. And we had companies such as, say, Coca-Cola is one of the examples that always put forward, that always relied on brand to a large extent, all these big coffee chains, right? So, and pricing the value of the brand is obviously very, very difficult. I mean, if you go, say, to Starbucks and pay, I don't know, I don't drink any coffee, but say €4 for a cup, and in the bakery next door, it is €1. Is the brand value then literally the €3? So, and basically you transfer the kind of added value to the low tax jurisdiction by licensing the brand from the location where the taxes are lower. I mean, that has historically been the mechanism. So is this effect just becoming more pronounced because more and more the economy is reliant on intangible assets? And especially with the move towards the digital economy, that is even more so true.
Yeah, I think this is true. So we have this big structural change towards digital economy. If you compare the most profitable firms in terms of stock value from, say, the 2000s to now, that there has been big change. So the firms with the largest expected profitability are now digital firms like Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and so on. And these firms are now becoming more and more profitable. And so these are the firms that engage in this kind of tax avoidance. And this is why we're talking about this now, because this is now scandalized. There is now the newspapers writing about it and people getting angry. Because they feel that these firms do not contribute their fair share to public goods.
And but at the same time, they are the ones that are in the news. But it's a more widely spread problem, because even traditional companies are digitizing to different extents. But I mean, even in what you would sort of term traditional industry sectors or traditional economy, digital technology will become an ever more important part of it. So basically the problems that we have been seeing in relation to, you know, what is the identifiable tax base, that will become worse going forward and spread towards, you know, what we considered the old economy companies, rather than remain isolated in the digital economy. Is that true?
This is true, and this is getting more and more a problem in these cases where more traditional firms, which do not have this opportunity to lower their tax burden so much, are in direct competition with firms that rely on more digital business models and where their assets are more fluid, or let's say intangible, and are easily shifted across borders. And you can think of the traditional newspapers are in competition with Facebook or Google, but there are lots of other examples where this is a problem, and where the tax aspect increases the pressure on the more traditional sectors.
Okay, so if the underlying problem is an economy that is shifting towards immaterial assets and towards the increased use of digital technology, and if that is even in the short term causing disruption and unfair competition in the tax base, so what can be done? That's the easy question, isn't it? So how can we tackle this problem of the very sort of soft tax base, and at the same time create a more even playing field?
Yeah, this is the crucial question, and there's lots of debate going on. And the good news is that policymakers all around the world have now understood there needs to be done something. And this is, of course, not just an intellectual exercise, see a problem and try to solve it, but there's lots of public pressure now. So this has been topic in the Europe Parliament election campaigns, and so there it will be in future political campaigns, and this is why policymakers are now feel that they need to do something, and so there's I think there's a promising thing going on within the OECD inclusive framework. So there's now 129 countries debating and really thinking about specific solutions to some of the most urgent problems. And so these problems can be, well, these are mainly two fundamental problems. The first is that some of these countries manage to be active in a country without being liable to tax at all. And the reason is that the current system relies on a physical concept of presence. So this is called the permanent establishment. You need to have a building there. Ideally, so in the old world, that was a building where machines are, where there's something going on, a permanent establishment with value creation in it. If you run a platform, you can easily be active. A digital platform, you can easily be active in a country without having any physical presence. But then the, so to speak, the prerequisite of corporate taxation is missing. And there's so there's a whole bunch of ideas how we can change that. And so we could think about a virtual permanent establishment, a digital presence. Somehow, and a lot of thinking is going into this direction. The other, and I think a little bit more important problem is of profit allocation. So once you have different affiliates in different countries, you need to allocate a given profit to these locations. And so if you allow the firm to say all profit belongs to that one intangible asset, which happens to be in this low tax jurisdiction, then you provide the firms with legal means to avoid, in some time, in some instances, almost all taxes. This will be different if when you say, okay, the intangible asset needs to be where the other production factors are, like labor, tangible assets, and so on. So some of these ideas go into that direction.
So you basically take, say, an idea of an algorithm and say, okay, if you use that algorithm in 100 countries, you have to split it up into 100 different pieces that are individually allocated to other sort of physical, sort of location-related aspects of your business.
This would be the consequence. Yes. So you split the profit that would usually accrue to the algorithm and allocate it to where the labor is that uses the algorithm. A whole other approach is to say, okay, let's get rid of this source principle. Let's not try to allocate profits where production is. Let's shift it to the market jurisdiction where the consumers are. And this is a more fundamental approach because it changes the rules that are in place now, right? So usually we think about value creation as something which is on the supply side. So the firm creates the value. Where is the firm? Well, where its production locations are and where its assets are and where its functions are and where the risk is managed. If we say, okay, the profit accrues to where they actually sell their stuff, this would be completely different. The main advantage of this approach is that consumers are pretty immobile. Okay, so if I buy an Apple computer, yeah, I won't change the location of where I buy it just because Apple could save some money. Okay. So this is the advantage. I'm not really sure whether this is as easy as some people today think it is, because the location can be manipulated, not in the way that I change the location, but that Apple sells all its stuff to some other company. Yeah, let's say, well, just another company, which then resells it at a small margin. So this intermediary company wouldn't make any profit at all. And the location of sales for Apple can be anywhere, right? In some low-tax jurisdiction. So this whole system would break down, or would require that the system looks through these structures and say, okay, in fact, it's Apple which sells the computer. It's not that other company. So Apple would need to pay their taxes in Germany, where I sit, and buy the Apple computer. And that could be imagined in the case of Apple, but it's very hard to imagine other cases where it's not that easy, where you don't have an Apple computer that is without doubt an Apple computer, not something else. Mm.
And obviously, especially for small and medium-sized companies, that would complicate operating business as well. I mean, a few years ago, the EU reformed its VAT system. And as somebody who sells, I think at the time, two books online, where the principle, I mean, the idea, if I remember correctly, was that because Amazon and others sold their e-books without any VAT out of Luxembourg, right, into the whole of the European Union. And then the principle changed, not the point of where the company was based, but where the consumer actually bought the book. But as a result, even the smallest of vendors had to register in 28 different countries for VAT. There was this, you know, there was an incredible burden, especially for small and medium-sized companies. There was this so-called VATMOS, which was meant to make it a bit easier on the national level, but you would still have to retain...
This mini one-stop shop.
Exactly, yeah, but you would still have to retain two pieces of information for 10 years, i.e. an IP location where the purchase was taken and a form of payment. So, I mean, how can a small company actually save that for 10 years and even in some cases get the information in the first place? The net result was exactly what you were referring to. The reseller market became much more pronounced, most of all, by coincidence, Amazon. So you now upload your electronic books to Amazon Kindle Direct Publishing. They sell it for you. You're not the seller. They are the seller. They deal with all the compliance issues that came about as a result of that principle change, and you get a royalty rather than the actual sale value of the book. So I mean, this sounds like we are caught between a rock and a hard place. I mean, either you make something incredibly difficult and intangible tangible by trying to split it up and allocate it to different locations, which is probably in accounting terms a nightmare to do, also internally for companies, or you change the whole principle around with the unwanted effects that you could have sort of intermediaries now in between that basically do not solve the actual underlying problem, but just create an extra step.
And if I may add to that, so in case of the VAT, this is not so much a problem for the from the revenue side, because the VAT base is not affected. If the corporate tax is in principle a tax on profit, and so if you have these intermediary companies, the profit may drop to zero. You just have this one intermediary, which just buys all the stuff and resells it and has a profit of zero. And this intermediary would be subject to tax in the country where the where the good is sold to the consumer. So this would be an effective way of reducing the overall tax burden. In your example, it is just of reducing the burden of complexity. Right. And but so the tax in the end is the same. Mm. So this is from a complexity is a big issue. And I think I have a feeling that it is on the radar those in charge. But as you said, it's very, very hard to solve. If you want to have something like a destination based VAT system, and you have these more vendors. This is something which is incredibly hard to solve. Maybe in the future, with better information technology, we will have some progress in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, you rightly say, because the VAT issue is a transaction tax. So the overall tax revenue remains the same, but it increases the complexity for somebody to deal with it. Whereas in the profit tax case, I mean, it adds transaction costs, but eventually that's the same thing. It reduces the actual tax burden to zero, because it just adds. And again, that would be probably a step that is only available to a certain type of big companies that yeah. You know, could actually afford to run this complexity and add this transaction cost to have the same effect in the end. So it wouldn't necessarily even the playing field either. So I mean, which one of these two ways would you think is the most promising way forward? Or is you can probably, it's either or, you can't mix these things, because you know, also need, at the same time, should keep the tax system transparent, manageable, fair, and all the rest of it. So I mean, what would you say, what's the more promising way forward?
There's even another approach, which is well, it's not as principled as the other ones that I just outlined. It's a very blunt instrument. It's called the GLOBE proposal, and it's an effective minimum tax. It's very blunt in the sense that Germany would, for instance, get the right to tax its the affiliates of its own firms abroad whenever their effective tax rate is below a certain level, and would top up the tax effective tax rate up to a certain threshold, the effective minimum tax. So that means if the Irish affiliate of some German company only pays 3% on their profit there, the German government would say, okay, we get another 7, such that your effective tax rate is 10. This GLOBE proposal would imply that this would even be for foreign firms that have affiliates here and that shift profits out of high tax countries. That means that this is a tax on base eroding payments. This is a very blunt instrument, and the smaller countries or the low tax countries are already complaining that this is a violation of their sovereignty rights. And they actually have a point. But this is the good thing is that if it works, it would be highly effective, because there would be no point at all for tax havens to have a low tax rate, because it would actually have no effect on the firm's tax payments. So if the large players implement this, and I'm pretty optimistic that in the end we will have something like that. The US already has something, a similar instrument, the GILTI. This would be the effective end of tax havens. Mm-hmm. At least for corporations. Okay, then tax havens have another function to shield private income for tax evading reasons. But for corporations, this could well be the end for tax havens.
And it's just then an accounting nightmare, because you would have to look at the effective tax rates being paid by companies abroad all the time, and then calculate it against your own measurements of, you know, the minimum tax rate.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of problems involved, as you can imagine. So the one of the important problems is the one that you allude to, is what is the accounting standard which is used to calculate the profit? And the official answer is there would be some accounting standard that everybody agrees upon, and the honest answer is our standard.
Right? Okay.
So this is part of this sovereignty issue, that the Germany would say, okay, Ireland has calculated profit according to its own standards. Is not our standard. According to our standards, the effective tax payments is much lower. And this is the standard that counts. And now we employ an additional tax.
So, but that would in effect mean every Irish company that has some dealings with German company, we would have to recalculate their accounts according to different accounting standards to get to that base.
In principle, yes. Yes. So there's all kinds of simplification that could be done. It goes in a little bit in the same direction of what the EU tries to achieve in terms of a common corporate tax base. So there is already pressure in that direction. But in principle, you're right that in terms of complexity, in terms of compliance costs, this can be pretty severe.
Yeah. But interestingly, this gets us into the second part of the issue. So we talk now about the difficulties about the tax base and what can or can't be done about this. So there's no easy solutions. That's probably the honest and straightforward answer. But there's also tax arbitrage and tax competition for the actual level rates amongst countries, even within the European Union. Even though very few companies actually do pay the headline tax rate, right? There is evidence for a tax competition, which seems to be in a collective action problem that even within the European Union, we haven't been able to deal with effectively. I mean, what is it called? A double Irish sandwich where, you know, holding company is Dutch and...
Double Irish Dutch sandwich, yeah.
Yeah, something like this. So, I mean, how would you characterize this situation within the European Union, maybe globally? And what can be done to avoid that sort of... tax competition amongst states.
Yeah, so starting with the Globe proposal, the effective minimum tax, this would be very effective against these measures. So the effective minimum tax is, as the title says, an effective tax. So it ignores completely the headline tax, right? It just says, okay, what is the actual tax payment divided through profits. Okay, so this is so all this playing around with the tax base would not be effective against this instrument. The other reform proposals are, well, they differ with regard to that problem. So shifting more taxing rights to the market jurisdiction is, as I said, in itself prone to new kinds of avoidance. But it would actually, if it works, it would get part of the profit that is shifted between source locations right now, would get part of the profits out of the game and shifted to the market jurisdiction where the consumers are. And if it works, that would, so to speak, reduce the incentive for the source locations to reduce their tax rates to engage in tax competition. So all these measures may, to some degree, are able to alleviate this problem. Right now, there's this strong incentive to become a location specialized in intangibles, right? And many countries do so. So the Netherlands, Ireland, so they all have specific tax instruments, tax provisions that target this kind of companies as holding companies for specific assets or for certain structures that enable firms to shift profit out of other high-tax jurisdictions.
So basically, and within the European Union, decision making in tax matters is unanimous, right? So you can't sort of overrule individual countries. So you would really have to have some sort of common European approach where, you know, some countries get some other benefit if they give up their sort of low tax strategy. I mean, I was in Ireland, or was it at the end of 2017? And they said, well, When Brexit is around the corner, it's probably the worst point of time to ask us to give up basically our business model, right? So, do you see any sort of way how this can be shaped into some sort of European-wide strategy?
This is the one of the advantages to do this in the under the roof of the OECD and not so much under the roof of the EU. You're right that I think all of these problems are problems within the EU as well. But they're, of course, larger than that. And if you don't get the US, China, India into your boat, so to speak, that would not make sense. And some of these proposals are, again, getting back to the effective minimum tax, are in principle could be implemented in a unilateral way. So the US did this. In Europe, that would be more complicated, but not due to the unanimity principle, but rather due to the European Court of Justice.
What would the problem there be?
The problem would there, it would violate one of the four freedoms. And so we have this, the ECJ usually is very strict. If the German tax applies to some Irish affiliate but not to some French affiliate, that would be a violation of the four freedoms and the case of discrimination. It seems so. This is a legal question, and so I'm not an expert, but I work with people who think that they that this is not a fundamental problem. So if you this is just a question how you construct this tax. If it's in principle applies to every affiliate, even affiliates in Germany, but these affiliates usually pay a large enough tax so that they're not affected by the minimum tax, it should be in line with the four freedoms, because it does not target a certain country or a certain nationality. It just targets low tax payments.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The principle is applied to everybody, no matter where you're from. So, and the application of it then depends on your individual circumstances. But that is not that's not discrimination if the principle applies to across the board.
It's still a little bit in the eye of the beholder. Yeah. If it's effectively a tax on Irish affiliates, then I don't know. It seems that the legal standpoint is not that clear, but there's at least some opinion saying, okay, you can't do that. If there is an agreement from 129 countries of the OECD inclusive framework, that would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. So to convince the ECJ that this is actually fine.
And is there also an opportunity to go step by step? I mean, if I understand you correctly, the idea of effective minimum taxation seems to be, at least in the short term, the most practical approach. But could that be the first stepping stone towards a system that is then either still the old principle or the new principle, shifting taxation to where consumption is? I mean, where would you see that develop in a reasonable fashion? Or would you say the effective minimum taxation, that's basically what we can do and that's what it's got to be? Or
I think in the end we will have a little bit of everything. The reason is that there are different camps in these the group of 129 countries. And so the US is very much in favor of shifting more taxing rights to the market jurisdictions. Well, you may ask why. It may have to do with the fact that they have a huge trade deficit. So Germany is not so much in favor of it. You may ask why, and may have to do. So Germany
with a sizable trade surplus. There you go.
Yeah. Germany is maybe therefore very much in favor of the minimum tax. And it seems so. People tell me that. So in the end, we will have a little bit of everything in it. Whether this is the most efficient or most effective way, I don't know. So if you ask for sequencing, oh, this is would ideally be done. I think there may be the case for starting with the effective minimum tax, because then you destroy the business model of the tax havens, and you get them into the camp that may have an interest in shaping a tax system that makes a bit, which is more effective, which makes more sense. So to be clear, that may actually lead to the tax havens having more revenue, right? So because if they know they can play around with their tax rate, and the firm doesn't pay more tax because they would either pay it here or they're paid in the high tax country, they have an incentive to now really go up to that minimum level. And for some tax havens, think of Puerto Rico. They're not that rich. Some tax havens are pretty rich, so they may not need the money. But for those who cannot get any revenue out of firms because they're not attractive as a location, just as a tax haven, that may be something which may actually help them, and they may switch to a business model that is more service oriented, and even at that margin, it may be more efficient because they cannot advertise their low effective tax payments anymore. They have to do something else. They have to engage in, I don't know, a good service industry, a good government services with regard to, I don't know, financial services that complement financial services. I don't know what can't be done.
Or they're moving more towards regulatory arbitrage rather than tax arbitrage. So they're putting their focus more on privacy issues and these sort of things, information being locked down in the jurisdiction, that kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe. Tax havens, some tax havens have these double functions, being a tax haven for corporations and being a tax haven for private individuals, these famous high net worth individuals that hide their money in these jurisdictions.
And I think what hopefully gets clear also for the viewers and the listeners is that, you know, there are some really tricky underlying issues under all these tax reform ideas. So it is not the case, as is often assumed, that sort of politicians just don't want to tax these companies or are in bed with companies. But there are some really difficult principle underlying problems that need to be solved for the long run. Also, there is no quick fix in the sense that, you know, a tax system should be, the principles of a tax system should be permanent, because it's important, you know, for businesses to be able to deal with the tax structure, and you can't change it, especially not the underlying principle every 2 years or so. So I think that is an important point to make, that, you know, it is a very tricky area of policy reform and not just a case where companies bought politics.
This is certainly true. So there's no outright corruption in any sense. But having said this, it should be, well, you may find that peculiar that so all of a sudden we can imagine of things being done. And for years or decades, it was just that, so we cannot do anything about that. It's just the rules, and we cannot affect the rules because we're a small country and so on and so on. I think the public pressure is a decisive aspect in all this, that politicians feel that they need to respond, otherwise they get punished at the ballots. So it seems that all of these large high-tech countries have their own tax havens, right? So the US has Bermudas and even Puerto Rico. The UK has Jersey, Isle of Man, I don't know, all these. Germany has Luxembourg, right next to it, where German firms can use structures to lower their tax payments in Germany and abroad, right? So this is, tax havens are used as a means of strategic trade policy. You can't tell me that the US is completely helpless when it comes to Bermuda or Puerto Rico. That doesn't make any sense, right? So they can, if they want to, they can shut them down almost immediately. They won't, and they don't. Why? Because they know that their companies are in competition with other companies that use their own tax havens. So there is this strategic trade thing going on, and this is why we need coordination. And so now there's this public pressure that forces people to say, okay, it doesn't make sense to move first. So to shut down all of our tax havens, and German companies are now at a strategic disadvantage in third markets. But it may make sense to have a global agreement that we change the tax system such that this implicit subsidy is reduced. Because we know from a global point of view, reducing subsidies in these instances is efficient.
Yeah. And we might have just straightforwardly reached a tipping point, because if you look at the tax revenues, more and more the immobile subject have taken over a larger share of the burden. And at some point, you know, that underlying feeling of being unfairly treated when others get away, others that would be much more able to afford to pay their fair share, you know, that led to the kind of public pressure that we're seeing now. I mean, we've seen research showing the extent of this, and that's gotten much worse in recent years again. Right. So rather than saying, I mean, from my point of view, of course, there's always been corporate lobbying, and that will always be the case. But, you know, the perception often is that there is sort of outright sort of being in bed with companies. And I don't get the impression that this is necessarily the case beyond the normal lobbying. What is now different, I think, is that, you know, previously, because of all these difficulties in reforming the system, people probably thought, well, there's not much to be won if you you know just take this hot potato, but now they have to, because the public pressure, rightly so, because you need, basically societies need this kind of tax revenue to finance public life, right, and public goods. You know, that reached a tipping point where now it is no longer an option to basically avoid the issue in its totality, and now. There's a pressure behind it. I mean, remember back, you mentioned the European Parliament election. I mean, 5 years ago, the financial transaction tax was one of the key campaign elements, and nothing has happened since. So maybe that is the difference between sort of 5 years ago and now.
Yeah, I completely agree. The only thing that I wanted to add is. So it's not about the revenue that we need, right? It's the if you look at the spending per GDP in almost all countries hasn't gone down since the 1980s, since the start of tax competition as we know it. It's what actually happens is that, as you said, we shift the tax burden from the mobile factors to the immobile ones, and we now have the evidence. So there's this recent AER paper by Peter Egger and co-authors that actually shows that, that globalization has led to more inequality. And we have other papers showing that corporate tax cuts increase inequality. And this is what happens when we try to engage in tax competition. So the collateral damage is our own distribution of income and wealth. And I don't know whether this, I hope it's not a tipping point already, but it's something which is now on the radar, and I think rightly so. And I think we need to tackle this, because otherwise much more is happening than just a little bit of outrage about these tax dodgers.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, the public spending as a percentage of GDP remained roughly the same, but you know, the burden of raising this money was shifted towards the ones who could least afford it, or yes. Certainly afford it less than the ones that paid a lesser share of it. Yeah. So, and then obviously this has to be reversed, and especially in view of some public policy issues that probably require some long term investment going forward. But let me come to the final question then. You know, if we talked a lot about the difficult set of problems, but if you were a policymaker and were tasked with, you know, what three steps do we need to take now? Step one, two, three. To try to you know, get a grip on the problem. Where would you start? What would be your top three priorities?
In terms of corporate taxation?
Or, yes. Yeah.
I think the first thing would be to implement an effective minimum tax, ideally in coalition with the main global players. Which, as I said, would be an effective tool against tax competition. Second one, there's these proposals that try to link intangibles more to the tangibles or to labor. I would try to push for that a little bit more. And the third one would be to push for harmonization of corporate tax bases, which would ideally start within the EU. So with these three steps, I think a lot could be done without any explicit harmonization of rates, without taking away from peripheral countries like Portugal, Ireland, and so on, their means of becoming or remaining an attractive location for investment. All these three steps would effectively mitigate tax competition. And I think it's a realistic way. So I could go further and say for unitary taxation of the whole world and implement the global treasury, but all this is not going to happen.
Well, that's also, I think, beyond the first three steps. Well, Johannes Becker, thank you very much indeed for taking the time this morning. And we'll see. I mean, maybe at least harmonizing the tax base might be something the new European Commission might want to get its teeth into. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.